listening to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and sitting in my lovely Westtown apartment is Seth Vanek.
That's me.
There it is. I've known Seth, in a way, for many, many, many years, but we didn't really talk until a couple of months ago when I booked one of his five bands at the Hungry Brain for a Monday Night series. Which band was that?
Love Raid.
That's the first of many plugs you're about to hear. Mm. Seth is a very, very... To me, Seth is a very inspirational man. Has anyone ever said that about you?
No.
That's good.
Nope.
I'm the first. Seth does a lot of things that I do, but he does it better and with a giant group of people around him, so... Where what I do seems weird and crappy, and a lot of times it's like just people putting on events in order to get drunk. Your events seem to be more artistically driven, where I'm just trying to like...
Oh, you've got me all wrong.
No, I feel like I'm just trying to sell Pabst,
uh-huh.
And you're mm-hmm. trying to like...
Drink Pabst
and greater the arts community. No, it's a compliment, man.
Thank you.
So, okay, you do a lot of things, and rather than cover them one by one, if you had to describe yourself, how would you describe yourself to someone you just met? I'll give you three scenarios.
Okay.
You're meeting someone like me.
Okay.
You've never met me before, and mm-hmm. I'm at one of your events, and I go, "Hi, I'm Brandon. What do you do? Why are you here?"
Yeah.
What would you say?
Well, I would probably say I'm probably there for one of a few reasons. Either my band is playing, or I helped organize the show, or something like that. But I would probably say I'm a musician.
Okay.
And, you know.
Are you comfortable with saying that you're a musician?
At this point, yes. But it took me a long... I gotta tell you, it took me a long time, actually, to I don't know why, but, you know, because I spend a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
like, rehearsing, recording, performing music. So, like, you know, it seems like that would describe a musician.
Yes.
But, you know, there's something about it that, I think... I just cringe to think of that as being like my primary identification.
A musician.
Right.
Okay, you don't, to my knowledge, you're not on any heroin.
Mm.
You're currently not on any cocaine or any narcotics of any sorts. Mm-hmm. And you didn't go to music school.
I did for a little while.
You did for a little while.
Out, yeah.
And you're not a dick.
See,
that's the thing. We didn't just meet. That's why I said that. I would call you a dick if you were a dick. You're not a dick.
I'd like to think so.
And anyone that I... Not anyone. Most of the times when I meet people that say, "I'm a musician," that's... To me, you're automatically an asshole.
Mm.
I would never call myself a musician. I've played over 100 shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm.
I see what you're saying.
I think my problem is I grew up thinking Kurt Cobain was a musician or an artist or whatever, but he was just a guy with a gun, and that's not always good.
Mm.
But this is about you, Seth. Why did it take you so long? Just because you were afraid to identify with a musician?
I don't know. I think I feel the same way as you do a little bit, in that I'm always aware of being around other really talented people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you get in this mode of like being, well, like, you know, I'm... You know, Dave Rempis, there's a musician.
Okay.
You know, or something like
that.
For
those of you that don't know, Dave Rempis is a jazz musician in Chicago. And actually, if you Google Dave Rempis, I'm sure like 30 articles will pop right up.
Yeah, he's huge in Europe.
Yeah, he's very big in Europe. And he's actually pretty big in Chicago.
No, he is. He's one of the, I think he's one of the you know, greatest, busiest tenor or just saxophone players in town.
Do you think he would describe himself as a musician?
I would hope so. I mean, he does a lot of other stuff, though,
he does
too.
A lot of,
and
he,
that's
the thing. He does a lot of things like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like he does booking.
Yes, he does.
And you do booking.
Yeah, yep.
So would you call yourself a booker?
I wouldn't do... I knew. No, I would not.
Why not?
I don't like that word.
Why is that?
I don't know why. Likewise, I would not call myself a curator.
Because that's like a fancy booker?
Yeah. That's because...
That just means we're going to lose you money?
Yes, except a booker that doesn't make money.
So what would you call yourself?
Well, I try not to get in those kinds of conversations.
We're in that now.
We are in that. I guess I would just, you know, I always have had trouble like just choosing one thing and sticking with it. So I've always tried to like diversify my
portfolio,
so to speak, my arts portfolio.
You're not lying on that, because you're literally in five bands.
The last time I counted.
Last time you stop looking at the notes. These are my notes. You were part of a group that ran a great performance space. You might call it a performance space. You might call it a house venue, even though it wasn't a house. Whatever.
By the time we were finishing with it, we were calling it a performance space.
Then you were a curator.
Right.
But you also do things that essentially, like, you advance the arts in a positive way.
I got involved with a group that whose mission it is to advance the arts.
And that's Homeroom.
And that's Homeroom.
And Homeroom is the people that do events at the Brain every month.
Right.
And I have yet to. And you brought this to me. I had never heard. Stop looking at my notes,
sorry,
man. It's okay.
I'll look at you.
No, don't look at me. That's awful too.
Eyes.
Look straight ahead at the Who.
Okay.
I think the Who.
Oh, yeah.
The Who is on my calendar this month. They're artists.
Yeah.
Anyways, you're truly a Renaissance artistic type of man. Makes you sound autistic. You mm-hmm. do a lot of things. Why do you think you do so much?
Well, I think that it's nicer to be busy than to not be busy.
Have you always been like this?
No, I don't think so. My story is this. I got really into music in high school, mm-hmm. and then when I decided to go to college, or when it was time for me to go to college, I decided I wanted to study music because it was the only thing I really liked. And then I did that for a couple years, and it was a little bit.
Where'd you go to high school?
Oak Park River Forest.
And that's just to the west of the city. It's a very supportive community in terms of the arts.
Yeah, great music program. I played in the jazz band and the orchestra and all of that kind of business. They had a great... my brother and my sister were involved in the theater, and they had a great... they had a school... All the
totally.
High school-y kind of stuff.
And then you went to college. Where'd you go to college?
I first went to a college out in the suburbs called Elmhurst College and studied music there for 2 years. Studied jazz drums.
And you studied... Oh, I didn't know this. We're learning. This is fascinating. Yeah. And you sighed with so much delight. Why did you leave Elmhurst College?
I didn't like being in Elmhurst. And I felt like I didn't like being in a music program. I found myself kind of getting more out of my, like... general education classes than my music classes, and the program was such that you would spend a lot. Once you were like halfway decent musician, you would be in like six ensembles and doing all these performances, whereas in like a lot of like more prestigious music programs, like you would be in a practice room 8 hours a day before they let you go in front of people. So like I felt like I was like really playing too much and not learning very much, and I got more interested in reading and writing and stuff. So that's when I transferred to DePaul. And I left DePaul with a degree in philosophy.
Why did you go from music to philosophy?
I don't know.
don't
know. And when I tell people that, it's like that's what they ask. And I think it was I just wanted to study something that was the opposite of something practical.
That you said music is more practical than philosophy.
Well, the way that it was going at that point, I felt like it was, because I was playing in like this jazz band that would play like gigs.
This is in Elmhurst?
Right.
Okay.
And like, like you put on a tuxedo and you play a wedding at a banquet hall. And this was like how you would raise money for the jazz band to go on like a trip for spring break. And it was a great experience because it was like a great training in how to be like a working musician,
Yeah, yeah.
But it made me realize I didn't want to be a working musician. I wanted to be like a hobby musician, or like a musician that played music for fun. So
what's the can't a hobby musician or someone that plays music for fun also be a working musician?
Yeah.
I
suppose that's true. Well, it depends on what is fun for you. I mean, for some people, playing other people's music, like playing in a cover band mm-hmm. at a bar once a month, is fun, and it is fun, and I do that, and that's great. But
if you had to do it 20 nights a month to make rent, not so much fun.
That would probably get to me, yeah. And at 19 or whatever, at that point where I still thought I was going to be able to take over the world, I thought. There's bigger things for me than this. I'll probably be in the next Radiohead.
So then you go to DePaul, and actually majoring in philosophy at an urban university is probably just as likely to be the next Radiohead as playing drums in the Elmhurst Jazz Band.
Yeah, well, right. That was my plan. I thought, well, here's what I'll do. I'll go and I'll learn how to read and write, and then I'll meet some really cool artist types and that smoke cigarettes, and we'll start a band, indie
rock
band. No, I did meet Charlie Dietz, though, who I know is a mutual friend.
Charlie's a great man.
Yeah, and a great musician, but we never really hung out that much. But I remember seeing him around campus.
I don't think Charlie hangs out with anybody, though. Does he? You know what I mean?
Yeah, he seemed like kind of a loner
type.
He
still
is
kind of a loner
type.
So. I'm not trying to talk shit about Charlie. I love Charlie, but I don't think... I think that's part of the reason why I like Charlie so much, is because I have no idea
mystery.
What's in... Yeah,
mysterious.
I don't know what's in that man's head. I don't think I ever want to know.
No one will.
No, I don't think.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to go... By the way, let's plug Charlie Dietz's stuff. Charlie's having an album streaming party, a listening party at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Oh, great.
The Friday before Valentine's Day. So it's Friday, February 12th at 10 p.m.
Wow.
Charlie Dietz's album. And the reason why it's at the Gene Siskel Film Center is because each song has an accompanying video.
Great.
Yeah.
Wow, that guy is a
and it's
factory.
Free. And it's free.
Unbelievable.
I know.
I think I have a homeroom event that night. Listen to me. This is what I've become. But if I didn't, I would definitely be there.
Have you seen Charlie's art?
No.
Oh, Charlie's a great artist, and one of my favorite pieces, and actually probably a fan favorite, is called Jerry Taft in Space.
Oh, wow.
And it's this really pixelated...
Is Jerry Taft the...
The weatherman on ABC7.
Wow.
This giant pixelated Jerry Taft head in outer space.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing. And people are like, why does this... It's like, why the fuck doesn't everything revolve around Jerry Taft in space?
There was a bus advertisement for a really long time of the whole Channel 7 news team,
mm-hmm.
where Jerry Taft had the most uncomfortable look on his face. It was delicious. It was just like,
Do you watch that newscast?
No.
They make fun of his weight almost nightly.
You're kidding
They make fun of Fatty Taft. It's awesome.
Do they use the term Fatty Taft?
No, but okay. I do. And all true Taft fans use that term. No.
Wow. I'm pro Taft, man. Skilling can.
Okay.
You
crossed the line. Because in the hierarchy, it goes hands down number one, Tom Skilling.
Okay.
He's God.
He's true blue Chicago.
He's true blue Chicago. His brother's a dirty fucking criminal.
That's great.
You know, he was number two to Ken Lay in Enron.
Wow.
Ken Lay dies of a heart attack right before they actually go to jail. Not Skilling. Dude's in jail.
Wow.
Tom Skilling is not his brother. I'm going to write a song and or book and or do a... I had to do something called Tom Skilling is not his brother. Tom Skilling is he's the longest reigning weatherman in Chicago.
Yeah, he's... Yes.
He could have gone anywhere and he chose not to. That's what I like in number one. Number two, he's gay, which makes him 10 times cooler.
Oh my God, totally.
Number three, his glasses. Fucking fashionable glasses on a 60-year-old bald gay man.
He keeps it real, too.
Number four, the Tom Skilling Snuggie.
What?
It exists.
Wow. I have to spend some time with Google.
Okay, that
apparently.
And it's so good. And number five, occasionally they'll do morning bits on the morning show featuring Tom Skilling making fun of Tom, and either he's essentially playing a pimp in every single one of these. He's like the Jay-Z in the Jay-Z Big Pimpin' video.
Oh my God.
It's so good.
You've enlightened me.
Now
I know a lot more about Skilling than I ever thought I would.
Why do I know about Tom Skilling so much besides him being so fucking awesome? It's because that's how we learn about things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And
mm-hmm.
just because I know about Tom Skilling doesn't mean I have to ignore Fatty Taft.
No, not at all. Or Steve Baskerville.
Steve Baskerville's a good man. There was another Charlie Dietz piece called Steve Baskerville Outside of 7-Eleven.
So this is a series.
This is a series. I'm not fucking with you.
I love this.
Let me just, really quick, in the hierarchy, hands down, okay. Skilling's number one, Taft's number two.
Okay.
The rest of them, fuck them. They're all okay.
Okay. So
Baskerville's okay.
They all have to share third.
The only one that is the last one is Amy Freeze, who's on WFLD Fox Chicago.
That's lower than...
I hate her.
Yeah, come
She's
on.
Amy Freeze, fuck you and your stupid name.
Yeah, I mean...
By the way, my name is Brandon Podcaster.
Yeah, right.
Fuck you.
You got to do a lot better than that.
Okay.
Have you seen the Nicolas Cage movie, The Weatherman?
I have, and he did his research at WGN.
I thought so.
Yeah, it was shot in, like, that's why the studio looks like GN. Yeah, it was shot in Chicago. Very good movie.
I thought that was a fine movie.
Very good.
Really
Nicolas Cage,
it.
I know this sounds like I'm a lying, underrated actor.
You know, I've been hearing a lot of good things about him in the
Bad Lieutenant
thing. Yeah.
I did not see that yet. Have you seen Leaving Las Vegas?
Yes, but it was a long time ago.
That was 95. That's when he won his Oscar. And then after that, he's like, fuck it, time to be rich. Then came The Rock and Con Air.
He was great in that hilariously edited YouTube video of Wicker Man that I watched.
Oh, I didn't see that. See, why do you need a hilarious edited version of Wicker Man when he is a movie, then the premise is, I have to take off my face?
Yeah.
Why do you need to edit anything? He made that movie for you to enjoy.
Oh,
Nick Cage is a fucking awesome man.
He is a good force in our culture.
Also, for example, this is like me saying, I'm the biggest Tom Skilling fan ever. Tom Skilling dies. What can I do?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to marry his daughter.
That's a great point. Well, yes.
Just like Nicolas Cage. I'm a giant Elvis fan. I'm going to marry his daughter.
Oh.
People like to forget. No, man.
You're right. That's a great strategy for success.
I don't...
Although he was already a Coppola, right?
Exactly, but it
So he wasn't
didn't
sweating
matter.
It in
he
that
was still,
category.
No, he was never sweating it for money.
Yeah.
And that's maybe why he's so brilliant. I love Nick Cage. I'm not joking.
No, I don't think that you are.
That's the problem. I am extremely sincere. Okay,
you're a man of great enthusiasm. I like that about
after
you.
After five minutes after you mentioned Charlie Dietz for the first time, let me actually wrap up my Charlie Dietz story.
Oh, okay.
He's doing that thing at the Gene Siskel on Friday, February 12th, and Charlie still has that print. And I've asked Charlie, let me go outside of the ABC7 newscast, because this is going on during the exact same
it's
time.
It's right next door to the Siskel.
It's next door to Cisco, right. And they have, at the end of the newscast, they pan to the people outside
that's
of it.
Right.
Let me hold up Tafton Space.
Oh, my God.
And that's it.
That's
fucking
brilliant.
TVs explode from joy. It's going to be so good.
Also, what do you think about, and I'm just spitballing.
No, throw
here,
it out. Throw it out.
Some kind of project in which Charlie Dietz plays Nicolas Cage.
That's
does he act?
Brilliant.
Does Dietz act? Get Dietz on the phone.
Dietz does act. Dietz, I know Dietz would act in this. Okay, that's it. That's it. Charlie.
You and me, because I know that you work in pictures, right?
I work in pictures. I work in pictures.
You make those Flickr shows? Is that right?
Yes, I do make the Flickr shows. At least I try to. I think if I actually made that, there'd be way more people watching that than any of my other stuff.
I think if you and I sat down, banged out a screenplay with Dietz.
And Charlie scores it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to write it before, and we can't. We have to find like the 10 Nicolas Cage's like mannerisms that everyone knows. It's Nick Cage, mm-hmm. So he doesn't have to really have any lines.
That's fine with me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Let's do this. That's our next project.
So you're saying we'll write a screenplay with no dialogue?
No. It could be an ensemble piece.
I see. Right.
It could be an idea of all of Nick Cage's films.
I like it. It definitely should be sort of post-meta Charlie Kaufman-esque.
It's already happened, man. I mean,
That's true.
Charlie's going to literally wake up, watch himself as Nick Cage. He's going to literally take off his face and put Nick Cage's on, but it'll just be Charlie's face as Nick Cage.
And it's just like, all a face-off reference.
No. Then we'll get to the Wild at Heart reference.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right.
And, like, Charlie will shoot himself in the head and it explodes rather than... You see what I mean?
Oh, my goodness.
Nick Cage, Charlie could watch Charlie's head being exploded by a different cop's... See, this is brilliant.
Yeah. Kaufman is going to be calling us.
I know. We're going to make no money just like Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah,
I like how
Synecdoche didn't really take off in the box office.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man.
It's like my first on my list.
It's so good.
I can't wait.
When I first saw it, I was like, this is all right. And every single day that has passed since I've seen it, about 2 months ago, I've thought about that movie.
Wow.
It stays with you in the best possible way.
Oh, can't wait.
And it doesn't necessarily bum you out. Like a lot of Nick Cage films, like Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah,
back
was a
to you.
Bummer of a movie.
Sorry, this is like literally an 8-minute detour. And you're still at DePaul in the story. You're at DePaul. You see Charlie Dietz
in the story of my life.
In the story of your life, there's a lot of Nick Cage.
Let's skip ahead to my first Nick Cage movie. Let's see. I don't remember. I remember seeing Leaving Las Vegas at too young of an age. I wasn't ready to see that. I think I was like 17 or something when it came out.
How could you say you were too? That's like the best. I was like that movie came out in 1995. I saw it the year it came out.
I saw it before I was an alcoholic.
You're not an alcoholic. Are you an alcoholic?
No, never.
As you hold a beer.
Yeah, right.
No, you're at DePaul. You see Charlie Dietz rocking around. You're there because you want to meet like-minded individuals and make music, and these like-minded individuals apparently smoke cigarettes in your story.
I don't know. No, I've never smoked cigarettes, but I did have this like weird sense that I wanted to learn how to read and write. I wanted to learn how to, you know, like the whole like narrative of like the liberal arts education. Like,
yeah.
I just swallowed that hook, line, and sinker, and I was like, I need to learn how to think so that I'm not dumb and people aren't putting things over on me all the time, because I'm like, if I just learn how to bang on drums, I might be kind of miserable.
Are you glad you did this?
I think so. I think in the long run, not that I didn't enjoy reading and stuff before, that sounds bad, but like, I think it did, at the risk of sounding like someone like a college recruit, an agent or something, like I really do think that it did help me have a more enriched sort of life, but the irony of it is, as soon as I left college, all I did was music. So I was in this like music business sort of music program, left it, got a philosophy degree. As soon as I graduated college, I started 3 bands, started a record label, moved into a warehouse, and started doing music like all the time and waiting tables.
But do you think you would have done that? You probably wouldn't have done that if you stayed in music school. You probably would have ended up hating what you ended up loving all along.
I don't know. I don't know what I would have done had I stayed in music school. I might have been... I think either way I would have ended up being a musician, but I think I just would be a different kind of musician now. Like maybe.
So in a way, to sum this up, in an awful sports analogy, you're Deion Sanders.
Okay.
And you were Deion Sanders on the Falcons, and you were like, this is the shit, but I got to also play some baseball here. And your music school was your baseball. And then the football is your music, and you're like, you know what, I should probably play some baseball for a few years. Maybe I'll become a better football player. You will go out and you win a World Series, and that's DePaul. You have that philosophy degree. Now you're a more well-known individual. But you know what? My true love's football. And even if I can't play football professionally, I could still announce for it and be in part of the game. And also, then I can get my own video game, like Deion Sanders.
I'm still working on that. The people from EA won't call me that.
EA Sports, it's in the game. So you just needed, you kind of needed, unbeknownst to you, a break.
I think that had a lot to do with it. Yeah, I put my drums away. I didn't really touch them for a couple years.
You really didn't play for like 2 years?
Well, I might have played a little bit, but it was never, it was always like just really, really not serious.
Okay.
And you know, and I like, I still like to do that when I have the time to just like, you know, I don't know. I like the fact that music has become something that I can use to like unwind and sort of like work out just whatever is mm-hmm. like kind of pent up or whatever.
There's no longer the big game, and now you're just playing for the fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm you know, of all the bands, even the most serious of my bands is still really like in no risk of ever being as serious as like a band that would be successful or be like, you know what I mean?
Is like, that because you're not like the band itself isn't trying, or you're just more realistic?
I think it's a
because awful bands make it. And it's not because they're good or even because they have a certain look or whatever. It's just because of pure sheer will.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can hire a publicist and you can make the big push and do all of that stuff. And, you know, there's a time to do that. You have to make sure you're making good music first.
No, you don't.
Well,
for you, maybe.
I think that it helps if you... Something I feel like I've tried to... I don't know. The band that I'm in that is probably the most quote-unquote serious band is this band Roommate, and I really like playing in that band. It's this guy Kent Lambert who's been writing and playing songs for a really long time, and I think one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to him and his music, I literally was like a fan of this band before I was in the band, and I would go to his shows and we would talk, and then my label ended up putting out a reissue of his CD, and then like he's like, hey, you should be in my band, and so I just have been ever since. And
how long has Roommate been going on?
He started, I think, recording under the name Roommate in about 2001.
Okay, so that's a pretty long time for a Chicago band. A while, band, yeah.
But yeah, and it's been, he was in New York then, and then he, and the band has been different incarnations with him just, you know, as a leader for years and years, and then just recently it's kind of settled into like a regular four-piece thing. You know, it's going pretty well, but I like Kent because he has a real, I think, just a good attitude about the idea of being in an indie rock band.
What's his attitude?
Well, he takes it very seriously, but not in the way of like, you know, kind of like, you know, he has a day job and he's married and he like, and he has other passions, you know, he's also makes videos and he's a video artist, but like, and you know, when we release an album, you know, like we'll, you know, he'll get a label to support it and we'll go play some shows out of town and we'll do all of the things that you're kind of supposed to do, but there's not this like unrealistic expectation that like, this is it, it's do or die. We're gonna, I mean, I've never been in a band like that, but I feel like there's this kind of like overblown notion of being successful as a band. Maybe I'm making this up. I don't know.
No, you're really not. I'd like to keep talking about this, but let's actually pause and take a quick break mm-hmm. here, and we're going to get back to the notion. God, this sounds totally like NPR. We're going to get back to the notion of being blah, blah, blah.
It's part two.
We're
going to
talk about
series?
Fucking bands and rock and roll. Okay, so hold on 1 second.
Eating everyone.
By the way, that was a little bit of Roommate's music, so now you kind of have an idea what we're talking about. But we left on the notion of having to be a successful musician, being in a successful band, and doing certain things like touring and making music videos, etc. But the older you've gotten, the less that has been, the less you've cared about that kind of stuff.
I think in general, like sort of the idea of success that I've sort of subscribed to is that if you just find yourself not achieving success, you just kind of change the definition of success, and then all of a sudden you can be a success.
That sounds either very, very positive or very, very sad.
Yeah.
Give me an example. Like, how does this relate to you?
Well, for example, for a while I got in, when I was sort of underemployed, I got in the habit of making a to-do list for the day, and I would always put a couple items on the list that were, like, really easy, just
make
to, like,
breakfast.
Get a running start. Yeah, like take a shower.
Yeah.
Walk
That's
up,
not a bad
walk
idea.
Walk upstairs. It's great, and then you get that running start, and you're crossing stuff off the list already.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and then you just extend that out over your life, like, don't die by the time you're 30.
Well, you're almost there,
I'm almost there, so I'm really, you know.
So, in your mind, what could make any of the five bands you're in more successful, other than, like, you're
yeah.
obviously having fun.
Yeah.
Or else you wouldn't be doing it.
No, that's true. Yeah, I think there's room, a lot of room to be a little bit more ambitious with promoting. I have such a distaste, as a lot of musicians do, for that part of the project. And but unfortunately, with the, you know, music landscape being what it is, that part of the project is more and more important, and it falls more and more to the musicians themselves. So,
well, it's kind of interesting that you said that, because you did run a label.
I did, and I never was very good at it.
It what was your label?
It was called Fresh Produce, and it was basically just my friend and I. We started this space called the Ice Factory, which was just a warehouse down in sort of West Town, Ukrainian village, that we would throw parties and concerts at. And so it was just kind of like the house label of that
yeah.
project. And,
so it's similar to like what the Whistler's doing right now?
Yeah, it seems that way. You know, like I was always in bands, so it would be like we'd put out my bands and our friends' bands. And like whatever kind of came through, we did a compilation one time of all like sort of the different bands in our little scene, which... Mm-hmm. You know, and then like some of those bands went on to be, you know, fairly successful, like Office and Scotland Yard Gospel Choir,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and like these guys that, you know, now are like, you know, up and coming and are up and up indie
yeah,
bands,
yeah.
you know. So, but I don't know. I think my whole trajectory has always been so focused on this. One thing about me is I've always stayed in the same place.
Like physically?
Yeah, like Oak Park,
Chicago. Yeah.
Never left. And I have this group of friends that I've had for, like, a lot of the people I've been playing music with, I've been playing with since I was, like, 16 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all rooted in, like, this, like, idea of just, like, friendship and, like, just really...
You sound like the better version of me, sir. No, it's true. I did the label. I ran, like, I'm kind of running in space.
Yeah.
I did all these
That's
things.
Right.
I haven't left. This is eerily
weird.
Similar, except your weight, you're in better shape than me. You can grow a real beard instead of a weird puby-looking beard. And it's I don't and you don't seem to reek of the same like motivational sadness and desperation that I have.
But I wish I could be as self-deprecating.
No,
as
that's
you.
So much wonderful. See, you're drinking to wind down from a nice day at work, and I'm drinking to get through to be able to sleep. Because I've been staring.
We are the same. My
no,
friend.
No,
you
no.
Just wait. We're gonna be.
I hope I wait because then I'll lose a lot of weight and don't feel as bad about myself. It'll be great.
We're just gonna keep. The longer we know each other, we'll just get more and more like each other. And we'll
oh, this will be awful.
Yeah, it'll be like.
We'll be like a Charlie Dietz song.
Yeah.
Like that segue to nothing.
That's a bridge to nowhere.
I remember running a label and that was a waste of time and money.
It's running a label is definitely something I was not
By the
ready
way,
for when I was
when
20.
I said yeah I was 20 so I was like
yeah.
like when I say running a label I'm full of shit
yeah
like I didn't do
yes
now looking back like I didn't do anything that was appropriate
yeah I know that describes my experience as well
yeah
except take myself way too seriously
mm-hmm.
well but
mm-hmm.
Yeah and like have these like you know like
did
I
you
remember
have meetings at like Denny's
oh,
and shit
oh yes
did you have an
god,
agenda
yes.
on like a giant yellow
oh,
sheet yeah.
yes you had the same note oh my god
did you have I had like a team of 10
this is getting creepy
I had like a team of 10 people around me at all
wow.
times not at all times but like for these meetings and like I would give them bullshit jobs
uh-huh
like your job
I wish I had 10 people it was me and one other guy who shares a lot of my same personality traits who incidentally is Aaron Rodgers who also runs Homeroom meetings and agendas and contracts.
Yeah,
we were presenting
yeah.
up their contracts with our friends.
See, here's the thing.
Yeah.
What did you use for your contract?
Aaron's mom was a lawyer.
Ooh, nice.
So, yes, you have no idea. So we incorporated as a company.
Did you really?
Yes.
that is, like, I kind of like, I need to do that now.
Which kind of saved our ass, actually, because eventually the city came knocking at our door when we were running this illegal venue. They said, hey, this is zoned commercially. And we're like, oh, we run a business. It's a record label. And they're like, oh, we'll leave you alone. So that turned out to be very lucky, because we actually had a business license with the city and stuff.
How much did that cost?
Oh, like $25 a year or something.
You need to fucking write me up some papers saying I'm a businessman.
I'll do that for you.
That's
very
so great.
Cost.
Wow, that's great.
What kind of business are you going to have?
I don't know. I just like that Jay-Z line where I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. That's
business,
a great
comma,
one.
Comma man. That's going to be on my business card, maybe.
Not a businessman, I'm a
business comma
man.
No, say comma, the word comma, yes.
That's great. Oh, man. God. I remember that book, this music called Business?
I think Aaron might have had
giant, giant, essentially the music label Bible.
Do you mean this business called music?
Yeah, that's what I said. Okay. This business called music. Okay. Did I stutter or something? Did I say the wrong name?
I thought maybe you said this music called business. But
I might have. Holy shit, no. This business called music, whatever. And it came with a CD. And the CD, a CD-ROM. But the CD.
A CD-ROM!
Which I bought at Borders at the corner of Harlem and Lake. They had a contract in it. So you can just download the contract, and you just change the names and stuff, and you take out what you want, you keep what you don't want, or blah, blah. Yeah, that's what you, like most labels, you take out what you actually want and whatever. Mm-hmm.
Anything that might benefit the artists, you take out.
So I signed it with like four bands. We ended up releasing nothing of the bands that we actually did, quote unquote, sign. Mm-hmm. And one of the bands was like really protective. I won't say the name because mm-hmm. I think they're still around. They're relatively nice people, but mm-hmm. holy shit, it was funny. They're like, we don't like this clause, and I was like, fuck it. Then I scratched it out in like permanent marker. I was like, it's gone.
Yeah,
and that was like the one clause that made it an actual contract.
Right.
So it's like, come on, you sons of bitches.
Yeah.
Like, what am I going to? I can't even fucking press your records. Like,
right.
What the fuck?
Right. Anyway, what am I here for?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why. I
just have to empty my bank account into disc makers.
Thank God. Uh-huh. See, I was lucky enough to have my friend Max, who I still play with. That sounds weird. he pretty much like bankrolled two of the releases from the label, and luckily the one release we only pressed the middle of the internet, and they actually went on tour and they made all their money back. So we made zero money, but he broke even.
Hey, breaking even is about all you can ask for with that kind of thing.
And then for our band, we was a giant loss, like a huge loss, because we had no idea of like selling. And whenever anyone would try to buy them, like we went on a short tour, we just gave them away.
Oh, totally.
And the one CD like I didn't give away was like an Iraq war vet.
Wow.
And like I kind of felt shitty about it, but I was like, come on, man.
It might have been.
I'm in Iowa on a Monday night. Somebody give me a fucking dollar here.
That's so funny. I think that's what really drew it into focus for me was like when I was in a band and representing the label that was trying to support the band.
Yeah.
It put me on both sides of this equation where it was like this lose-lose proposition for me, and that's where I realized, okay, I got to choose one or the other, and I don't want to be a businessman.
Well, here's the thing. You kind of are a businessman, though, with your homeroom stuff, because that's truly a business.
That's a non-profit organization.
It's still a business.
It's still a business, but I have shrewdly removed myself from the business aspects. The real spearheads of that organization are these two gentlemen named Steven Stein, who's across the street from us right now, and the aforementioned Aaron Tavrov mm-hmm. Rogers, a very old associate of mine since about circa 1986. And they decided that they were going to set this up, and they talked to me, and I said, okay, well, that sounds cool. Why don't you guys file all the paperwork and then get back to me?
Yeah,
and I thought,
yeah.
Thinking at the time, they'll never get through fucking paperwork for a nonprofit. It's a nightmare, you know?
Yeah.
But they stuck to it, and it took them like a year, and they talked to a lawyer, and they did all this stuff, and they got it all together, and they got 501c3 status, and they're like, all right, what are we going to do now? Let's get a space. And I was like, oh, man. They're like, Seth, you're the artistic director. Why don't you put together some stuff?
So you get to do all the fun stuff.
Right. So I set it up very carefully so that I would do the stuff that I already kind of know that I'm good at, which mm-hmm. is like, you know, get, you know, talking to people and getting people on board to like do silly stuff like show YouTube videos or play songs and or something like that. And then they like write all the checks and they do all of the, like, you know, I'm getting more involved in like sort of the board of directors and fundraising and all of that stuff. I don't want to make it sound like I'm not gonna you know, hold up my end of the bargain, because they'll probably listen to this and then be like, that bastard. But I'm very realistic about what my skill set is now that I'm 29. Like I realize, okay, I'm not good with money.
Okay. But are you bad with money? Or are you just okay with money?
I don't have any.
Are you going to lose? If I have a business, are you going to lose me money? Am I going to make a lot of money, or am I going to be able to barely stay afloat?
I think my problem with money is that for me, breaking even is like my goal.
That's good.
That's usually my goal. That's like the most I expect out of anything.
Same here. It's okay. Awful.
Yeah. It's like, you know, maybe I could set my sights a little higher. But
did you ever notice, though, that like the people that could actually make you a lot of money, you never want to talk to?
Exactly. Right.
And you want to hang out and party with the people that lose all the money.
Right.
And then when you want to get coffee or movie, it's the people that could barely make the money back.
Right.
It's awful.
It's. I find myself trying to just gravitate towards a space of that sort of breaking even. Sort of like if I balance it out, I have plenty of people I work with that are on one side of that and on the other, and I just kind of want to find this area right in the middle.
You want to have a cocoon.
I just want money to not be an issue. Basically,
yeah, bullshit.
That's what everyone says, I think. But especially with Homeroom, I think that. In fact, I need to talk to you about this in regards to the Hungry Brain. But like, we're gonna try to set up our spring semester so that all of the money issues for every event are taken care of before the event even starts.
That's very good.
So, like, we'll make an arrangement with the Hungry Brain ahead of time and say, what would be ideal to make on a night like this? Cut you a check for that off the bat. Give the artists their stipend before they say a word. You know, and then say to the audience, hey, you don't, you know, you decide what this is worth to you. Yeah. You give us a donation.
See, the difference between you and me is I don't pay anybody anything.
See, and that's what I love about this Homeroom thing because...
I mean, people get money.
Yeah.
People, it sounds like I, like, take the money myself.
No, you do give a lot of money to a lot of people.
But I promise nothing. Does this make sense?
But
that's... I don't like charging a cover at all.
Right,
like, I'm kind of against it.
Right.
So no cover is charged. Therefore, if the artist makes no money, that falls on the artist.
Right.
Because I let the artist know and everyone that's, like, in the production end of this that we are going to pass around a donation thing.
Right.
Or you can sell merch. Or you can buy that artist a drink.
I think we're essentially talking about the same thing.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you're saying, like, cutting a check, no checks involved. I'm serious. It's like, let's keep this as basic as possible.
Oh, yeah.
And this is, it's really no different than a house show.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's how I operated for a really long time, was just like, you know, asking people for donations out of goodwill, saying this money is going to go to the artist, which it did for the most part.
Yeah.
Sometimes it would go to pay our gas bill or whatever.
I mean, if I spend like $20 on posters, I'm going to probably take $20 from posters, but I'm going to tell you like, hey, I printed this many posters and I did all the distribution for this.
Yeah.
I
think that's a fine policy. I mean,
exactly.
One of the things I like about the longer I'm around Chicago, I don't run into very many people who seem to be in it to get rich.
Well, that's the thing.
I think everyone's kind of come to terms with the fact that they're not going to get rich doing whatever they're doing, but at least nobody that I hang out with.
But everyone, you know. Maybe that's because a lot of the people that are trying to get rich, they leave Chicago.
Which is good for Chicago.
here's my question. Do you want to leave Chicago?
Never.
Really?
I've never had a desire to. As
a musician?
Well, I mean, I don't really have anything to compare it to, but I've never felt the...
Have you spent time in New York?
I mean, I've gone there on vacation a couple of times, and it's been, you know, it's overwhelming. You know,
what about L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, same thing. I mean, I haven't really spent as much time in L.A. as I have in New York. But from what I've heard, it's, you know, there's a real music industry to speak of in both of those cities.
Yeah.
There are people that can have a good living from being a professional musician. And that might be the case in Chicago, but I don't think to the same extent. Like, you're not going to get called in to do session work. You're not going to get a job playing bass in the David Letterman band. Or, you know what I mean? Like,
you have no desire to do that.
No, I think that goes back to what I said about making that decision when I transferred colleges. Like, you know, if I had practiced a lot and really studied music...
But there's a difference between being in the Letterman band and being a session musician.
Yeah.
Because the Letterman band is a night-to-night job, but it's still only a few hours.
But it's a job.
It's a job. Right. Where a session musician could be like 2 weeks of work and then nothing for 2 months.
Right.
You have no desire to do something like that either, because you're in five bands. It's not like you can't do that.
I'm not saying I'm not a mercenary. Particularly, like, recently, I've been getting a lot more comfortable with the idea of playing drums for money.
Mm-hmm.
And lately in my life has been taking a certain direction where I'm in a little bit more contact with people from that way of
when you say drums for money, is it like wedding drums? Is it like recording?
I haven't played any weddings recently, but I've played in a couple what musicians would call a jobbing band, but what most people would call like a cover band or a bar band.
Okay.
And that's where you're playing like covers of songs that you wouldn't even really want to listen to for money.
Is it different because you're a drummer Because you, I'm assuming, could turn your monitors either off or all the way down and still be pretty much okay.
You mean in terms of just when I'm
like
playing?
Actually listening, yeah. Because I was always thinking if I was going to have to be in one of those type of bands, I'd have to be the drummer. Because everyone else kind of has to concentrate. But for like a Tom Petty song, I could probably name 20 with the exact same drum progression. Same with Springsteen. And there's nothing wrong. Same with the Beatles. Same with every great band. So is it easier to just detach yourself because you're literally hitting stuff? And I'm not saying it's not a skill. I'm just saying it's a lot harder to ignore if you have to play like that solo.
I was talking with this great saxophonist reedist named Kevin Kaiser the other day, and he started out as a drummer, but now he's a great saxophone player, and he said that we had been doing some playing together in this sort of professional environment, and he's like, oh, I like how you're playing. You really listen a lot. And a lot of drummers don't listen. And like, there's like two kinds of drummers. Or somehow we came up with this theory, but there's like two kinds of drummers. There's like a drummer with lots of chops. In other words, like a drummer that can really play a lot of great licks. And then another drummer that can just kind of listen and react. And I think I try to fall into the second category.
So that's so it's like more jazz drumming.
Well, perhaps, yeah. I mean, I when I play pop music, I try to be aware of the structure of the song, what the song's trying to do. You know, like where is the climax of the song? Where does the verse happen? Where does the chorus happen? You know, the drums, you have a lot of chance to do a lot of things texturally, you know, because you have essentially a whole ensemble of instruments. You have metal cymbals and you have drums and all this stuff. So you can do a lot. And I try to approach it, like, seriously. But, you know, I have played Tom Petty songs in bars in the suburbs.
There's nothing wrong with Tom Petty songs.
No,
there's
I
a
love
lot
Tom
wrong
Petty.
With bars
I
in the suburbs.
Tom Petty.
Petty
my first
fucking
concert.
Rules. Yeah. Oh, really? Where did you see him at?
The United Center on the Wildflowers tour.
What year was that?
That would have been probably, I would say, like 1995.
Was that a solo album? That's the You Don't Know How It
you
Feels,
know, I
right?
I think that was, yeah, I think he let the Heartbreakers kind of take a break for a second.
Yeah,
no
but that
intended.
Tour was
yeah, it was
Heartbreakers.
Tom Petty.
Well, oh, was not the Heartbreakers?
Not, you know,
is
I don't
that
know.
The tour Dave Grohl played drums?
No. Okay. No, he had some kind of session-y guy on that. But I remember he put out that record, and it wasn't Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Because Full Moon Fever, I think, was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Your record, that record, the one, Wildflowers, is it?
No. Wildflowers. It was like Rick
Brown?
Rubin. Yeah, Rick Rubin produced it.
Yeah.
And it was
like
kind of this more like rootsy Americana.
It's good. It's a good record.
Yeah, I really liked it at the time when I was 15.
No,
I probably would still listen to it now if I had.
Who opened? Do you remember?
Ooh, good question. Who opened? Gosh, no.
See, I remember my first show way too well. It was the Smoking Popes and the Foo Fighters at Milwaukee Summerfest.
Nice.
Which is completely dumb considering I'm from Chicago. And I went to Milwaukee Fest because I love the Foo Fighters so much. And it was a free show because it was like you just pay $5. It was on the side stages. And I remember not seeing anything from the Popes because I let a cute girl stand on my bleacher. I kind of don't regret it, and I kind of do regret it. So
I wouldn't if I... That sounds like the most perfectly quintessential...
She had a boyfriend there that I didn't know was there until she was already on the bleacher. I was 13 or 14 and had yet to kiss a girl, so fuck that guy. And then I saw the Foo Fighters, and it was great, because I got to see Pat Smear play with him before he quit.
I don't know who Pat Smear
is. You don't know who Pat Smear is from the Germs? Guitarist from the Germs? Then he was the second guitarist in Nirvana.
Oh, my God.
And then he was in the Foo Fighters for a few years, and then he quit midway through the Color and the Shape tour, and then rejoined the band when they did that acoustic rock bullshit.
I remember that.
A few years ago.
It was like a double
ago.
Album, right?
Yeah. What a waste of talent.
Really?
Oh, it's awful.
I gotta say, I do like that Dave Grohl. I think that he is one of the finest drummers.
He's a good drummer.
I don't know how I feel about the Foo Fighters, though.
Listen to some of the early B-side stuff. It's so good.
Yeah.
It holds up with the like almost the best Nirvana
stuff.
Part
of me really loves the idea of like here's a guy who's playing drums for years and then he gets his shot to be like the front man and there he goes.
Here's the thing
Look
though.
Out, they're like the most famous band in the world.
He kind of and kind of no. He was recording all that stuff before he even joined Nirvana. So none okay. It was like he wasn't stepping up. He was already doing it and he recorded these tapes called Late. That was the name of the tape, and that was the name of the band. So he was. These were circulating for years before the Foo Fighters existed.
Gotcha.
Every single song on that first record had been cut in 90, 91, 92. And then he redid it all within a week in, like, the fall of 94.
Yeah.
And then it was released in 95, and then he formed the band. The band never played a show when they took that photograph, Jesus Christ, that his then-wife Jennifer Youngblood shot for the inside booklet for Foo Fighters. And that's proof that I did not kiss a girl until I was 15 or 14. Anyways, let's
there
go
you
back.
Go, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's go back to you.
Oh, jeez.
You're working in a homeroom stuff. It seems to be like the best of both worlds because it's not it's the Ice Factory type of stuff, but it's a lot more controlled environment.
Yeah.
Now that you have this nonprofit status, you don't have to worry about getting shut down. And also, it doesn't seem like you're risking a lot of money, you personally. I don't know about the organization.
Right.
And though that doesn't sound important to like a 20-year-old who's just starting out and this kind of stuff, the older you get, that's very, 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 very important.
Certainly. I mean, the Ice Factory was, you know, that was a great project in that, you know, it really shaped a lot of the partnerships and projects that I have now. That was from about 2002 until 2006 or 7.
And for those of you that don't know, that's a crazy long time for a performance space. Most are six months and done, and there's a reason for that. They usually don't know how to manage it because it's just... It's essentially a party to a lot of people, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
It's great. It's
we
very important.
We did a lot of partying at that space, but then we also, because we were this like weirdly business-minded, I don't know if that was because of the label, or we were also just very paranoid, and we were aware that it could this could all end at any moment.
Yeah.
So there was this awareness, so you could only take it so seriously. But then at the same time, we started noticing like... you know, when I was coming up in high school and college, I really loved a lot of the thrill jockey scene, and I loved Tortoise, and we all listened to Scene Cake. And we started noticing, like, some of these guys and these bands would actually, like, start playing at the Ice Factory on, like, their side projects and their jazz groups and stuff. And I was like, man, like, 3 years ago, I was listening to these guys' records, you know, like, at my apartment, and now it's like, I'm meeting them, they're totally not pretentious, they're, like, you know, these great, just down-to-earth guys. And I'm like, this is why I love Chicago, because, like, these guys are, in my book, at the top of the heap in this music scene.
Yeah.
But they're not, you know, they're not the Foo Fighters. To use an example, you know what I mean? Like,
totally,
they realize
they're
not going to get, like, signed to Warner Brothers tomorrow. You know
but
what I mean?
But at a time, though, happen. I mean, like, they could have been. Tortoise, I mean, could have been on a major label. I mean, hell, they were on Lollapalooza, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know, like...
I mean, they've done as good as an instrumental indie rock band can
it's
do.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But some of these bands, they did, I mean, 10 years ago, they could have been that big. So is it a time and a place thing, or is it simply just a place thing? Is it from being in Jesus Christ, living in Chicago?
No, I mean, I think, I don't know. It's a great question. I think it would probably just have to do with those guys. I mean, for one reason or another, they either decided, I mean, I can only speculate about
of course.
But, you know, it seems to me, you know, John McIntyre, I know, has a career as an engineer, and he has a great studio, and he does a lot of work there. And you know, it just seems like, well, why would I go set up shop somewhere else just because some corporation is going to subsidize my career when I have Bettina Richards I've been working with for, you know, a couple decades, who's going to put out whatever I want, you know, whatever I do, and be supportive and cool about it. I think it's just, it's a priorities thing, and you know, it makes sense to me. Somehow that makes more sense to me, like, than these people that it just, there's just like weird, this is going to sound judgmental or something, but I feel like you can put yourself in a relationship to success where you just, you know, really your only option is to be desperate for something, or you to be waiting around for something to happen to you, or to, like, you know what I mean? Whereas if you just kind of do what you're going to do anyway, and then, I don't know.
It's not a you-against-the-world situation.
Like, yeah, I don't really... I'm a little bit losing my train of thought, but, I mean, I think it's a nice town to be able to, like... You know, I played in a couple bands that I would just start with my friends, for example. And having this Ice Factory space was great, because we could rehearse there for free, we could record there, and we could perform all under one roof. I never had to leave my house.
Yeah.
And so it was this great, like, training wheels of, like, getting a band off the ground. And then, you know, in 6 months... a year, we'd be playing Subterranean, we play in an Empty Bottle, we got to get a hideout, and then these are the places where I really love to go see shows. And I was like, this is great. Like, the curve, the learning curve here is, like, really shallow. Whereas, like, in New York, it seems like, you know, A, good luck finding a rehearsal space.
Well,
A, good luck paying rent.
Yeah.
You know, B, good luck getting a rehearsal space, or getting a gig at, like, you know, whatever the
knitting factory or
right,
something.
Exactly.
But maybe that had more to do with your supportive group of friends than the city you were
in. Yeah, that's true. That had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
Also, because personally, my role is always as like a collaborator. I don't write songs. I'm not a composer or anything like that. Like, I can only really do the creative work I like to do if someone else that has creative ideas comes along and needs help.
Okay.
So like so one of the reasons why I would never move away is because I really thrive on these people that I've been able to form. Exactly. So like Justin Petertill, who writes all the songs for Love Raid, for example, we've been working on music for as long as I can remember. You know, that's great. That's one of my juiciest sort of collaborations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kent Lambert, who I mentioned earlier, of Roommate. You know, so that's, I like to just kind of insert myself into a situation.
Totally.
And the homeroom is the same way. Like, I realized, you know, here's a big group of people that kind of, you know, revolved around the Ice Factory thing. Why don't we keep that yeah. energy going? And here's this great network of people that I go way back with, I can trust. And we
it
have
really is nice. It really is like the Thrill Jockey story or the Drag City story or any other, or the Bloodshot story, where it's a group of friends and you're doing something you all love and it's surprisingly still going on.
Yeah, I think that has to do with the fact that a lot of us have just not created other options first.
But that's wonderful.
Which is great. No, it's great. I mean, I hope it can last a lot longer. And it's nice to see us, you know, transitioning into like a more adult way of approaching it. Like, okay, well, we're going to start a nonprofit and we're going to start raising money from people that actually have money.
Yeah.
And then giving that money to the people that don't have money but do the creative work.
That's great.
So that's how I kind of see our role right now is like, yeah, I'm going to cut a check to the Hungry Brain. Yeah, I'm going to cut a check to Sean Campbell or whoever's going to do a lecture. Like, because, you know, that money is in the bank because someone, you know, is donating to us because they can write it off.
That's really nice.
Yeah, I think it's a good...
I'm not used to that support system whatsoever.
Yeah, I really like the idea a lot. It's really exciting to me. Originally, the plan for Homeroom was to actually get a space.
And yeah.
So have it be like...
Are you guys still thinking about that or no?
Yeah, we are. It's definitely in the works, but it's a long-term goal.
Is that because having it stuff in bars is like you can't have it all ages, or is it too limiting?
Well, originally,
Do you want just a central location? What's
the deal? That was our mission originally because that was just where we were coming from. We were used to having a space, and so that was the way we knew how to do what we were doing. But then I think the more we kind of were talking about what we should be doing, the more we realized that the problem is not a lack of space. I think there are plenty of great
venues.
Yeah,
there are.
So, you know, Chicago doesn't need... You know, when you have these discussions about, you know, what is our mission? You know, you think, well, what need are we fulfilling? Because that's what you're going to say when you go to someone to get a grant. You say, okay, here's the need. Here's how we're filling it. And that's not a need.
Yeah.
The Hungry Brain is a great thing. The You, Me, Them, Everybody Night is a great thing. But if we can come to you and say, hey, we're going to provide some really solid content, you're going to be like, God bless you. This is
yeah,
great.
Totally.
This is one less night I have to worry about. And so if we're able to do the same thing at Elastic and then at Nightingale and the other places that we work with... to me, that seems like a useful service because then we're free to just concentrate on, what we call programming.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, let's get some people around a table and talk about what would be a really great show or event. And let's just have the luxury of doing that without having to worry how it's going to make money, having to worry about how big of an audience are we going to attract. You know, like if we can make an argument to donors that this is going to be worthwhile and they can trust us, then you kind of take all of those other things off the table. And you can really concentrate on, well, what would be really interesting and fun and inspiring for
yeah.
people. And that's, to me, that's the best work we can do as a nonprofit is like, let's just use whatever status we have to open up that space for people to just concentrate on the content and the programming
yeah.
and make it as good as they can make it without, you know, being stressed out about how is it going to be a success,
of course,
or, you know, financially or otherwise.
Do you see yourself doing this in 5 years?
Well, I guess so. I'm notoriously bad at thinking ahead, but I think of all of my projects, the homeroom one feels the most serious and mm-hmm. adult because it has all of this.
Well, let's go through the bands. You're currently
the bands. You know, I always think I always approach bands like. Thinking, always sort of assuming that they could fall apart at any minute.
Okay, but you do have that, though.
I do have the bands, and I really like being in the bands, and I should, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm going to just, like, you know,
yeah.
quit on my bands or something. I mean, those are things... I don't see myself, like, yeah, deciding to like settle down and stop playing music anytime soon. But as far as the homeroom thing, that feels like something that I'm like intricately involved. Like, but if I quit Roommate, they could find another drummer and do fine. You know what I mean? Like, the songs would still be there and they would do fine, and it, you know, it would be different, but it would be, you know. Whereas like with this, I feel like a little bit more.
What about the, you currently record bands as well?
Mm-hmm.
Which we didn't even talk about, and we're like 40, like 55 minutes in.
Oh, geez, this is going to be a record long.
No, it won't. Trust me. I'll double. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
We'll edit the parts out about
it. I will edit nothing. if you haven't learned that by now. I did edit the shit out of the live podcast, though.
Oh, yeah.
I cut about like 40 minutes out of that.
Oh, my God.
That's reason to come to the live version of it, because you'll get to hear all that
like
stuff.
Like the director's cut.
Exactly. The really shitty director's cut. But you also record bands.
Yeah, I record bands more as a function of being in bands than I think out of an actual interest to be like an engineer. I do enjoy it a lot, and it's something that like is very, has a lot of facets, and it's very complicated. You know, there's a lot of craft involved with it, and I can sense myself getting better at it over the years. And again, I've had really great partners and collaborators on that, particularly Gerard Barreto, who's an excellent engineer who I've worked with on almost every recording project I've done over the last 4 or 5 years, and also Vincent Naples, my current roommate, who's also a great engineer. So it's that, but like I said, I'm more interested in sort of the, I don't know, it's, you know, it's there's a lot of traps, I think, with recording. There's like the gear trap where you think, well, if I get this certain kind of gear, then it's going to sound good. And there's sort of the, I don't know, like the magic, like the idea that like we're going to have this magic take. There's going to be a magic moment where everything's going to come together. So, but it's, you know, it's a very practical project. It's like, how do we capture the music we want to make? And it's satisfying because when it works well, then there is this like, it's satisfying in a way that other stuff isn't, because it's going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
You can look, but you can
it's
go back
document.
To it, right? And you can go back to it. And I don't, very little else that I do is that way. So it's nice to have that.
That's true.
So
but do you
yeah.
see yourself doing that in 5 years? Once you're, let's say you're not in any band in 5 years, you're not currently living with these people. Would you even want to?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. I would if it. I mean, I think I've sort of committed myself to a lifestyle where I don't have what you might call a career, like a serious career. So I see myself just doing whatever kind of presents itself as a feasible way to either make money or, you know,
Be feasible within a reason.
Yeah. So if circumstances presented themselves in which I would, you know, someone would want me to help them record their music, then yeah, I would do it. But I mean, like I said, I think it's just something I do as a means to an end rather than like as, something in and of itself that I enjoy. I enjoy it only insofar as I enjoy making the music associated with it. Like, you know, having I have this love-hate relationship with having a studio, you know, because if you want to have, you know, inevitably what happens is when you have a studio and you really want to make money, then you start having clients and you start putting ads on Craigslist, and then you get some bozo coming in and be like, yeah, I really want to record my masterpiece. I'm a singer-songwriter, and of course he's awful.
So you want to have the ability to say no.
Yes, right, which is...
You don't want to have to do the Steve Albini thing where, like, it's a job, I will record everyone, and I will do a good job with everyone, but I do not necessarily endorse this music.
That, again, is the little bit, the you know, it'll kill you, your soul a little bit.
Yeah.
The same way I wouldn't want to play 20 dates of wedding band music.
Yeah.
You know, which, again, sounds kind of pretentious, but, like...
No, it really doesn't.
I diversify my artistic portfolio just so that I can have... I can just do enough
now
of each thing.
That sounds pretentious.
Yeah.
No, but it's good, though, because...
Yeah, you just got to have little bite-sized bits of each, you know, I don't know.
If you've ever listened to this podcast, you'll see that I have a lot of people in here that do one of, like, the four things you do. Like, I have a musician, and he only is a musician. I'll have someone that works in the arts that only works in the arts. And I'll have somebody in here that does book or curate, but they don't play in anything. Or I'll have someone in here that used to run a space, but the space lasted for 6 months, and now they're burnt out both physically and the spaces, too. So it's weird. Or have a label. And I know if you're probably staring at my notes, you have a giant resume here.
See, and it's funny, because I think of a resume as something that you would use to... But no, I see what you're saying. The problem, you know, it's the sort of the old cliche of jack of all trades, master of none. So you kind of have to come to terms with it.
Pretty much, that's pretty much what we've been getting at for almost an hour. Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Do you wish you only did one thing? Because I get that all the time. Why don't you just do the podcast? I have to do these other things. Pretty much, do you feel like you have to do any of this?
I will answer if you answer. Because
of course,
if we're in the same boat.
Definitely. I have to do this.
It's a big theme for me, and I desperately wish that at some point I would have just said, yeah, I'm just going to go to grad school for X.
Same here. And I actually applied for grad school last year, and I'm really glad a year on that I did not get in.
Yeah.
Because I know, like, I wanted to do creative writing, and only because I wanted to be an English professor.
Yeah, nice.
Because it's the easiest, like, pyramid scheme in the world. I just wanted to teach Hemingway and tell everyone they were wrong.
The kids basically teach themselves.
Kind of.
You just have to stand there.
Kind of. I just wanted to yell at people and get paid for it, but I do that already. I just wanted to. I wanted health insurance while doing it.
Yeah,
but now it's like, I might do that, but that's my fallback.
Yeah.
Now, but I have to do these things.
Yeah.
If I don't do this, like, this is preventing midlife crises.
Yeah.
This is preventing a ponytail. This is preventing, like, having a kid 4 years ago to fill a void in my life. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I think, you know, that makes sense to me, the way that you put it. You know,
yeah,
but
mine sounds spastic and crazy, and you seem very rational and calm.
Well, that's a very carefully constructed facade that I've put together.
Is it really?
It started as just a facade. I realized, well, I have to present a facade to my parents so that they don't worry about me.
What do your parents
so
think about this stuff?
They're the nicest, sweetest people.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, no, so yeah, they you know, they're just thrilled that I haven't, you know.
That's nice.
Joined the circus or something. Yeah, it is nice. It's very nice. And
it's that Oak Park strong community, man.
Yeah, you can't beat it. But it's, yeah, it can be a little disconcerting if you realize that, well, I'm, you know, it can definitely feel like, well, I'm just sort of half-assing five things instead of whole-assing one.
Are you half-assing it, though?
Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, the challenge is to really be in each thing with your whole ass.
Yeah.
When you're in him.
Yeah, completely.
You know, you can't do you know, I have definitely a love-hate relationship with the idea of multitasking. I'm really into the idea of monotasking, but monotasking at something different.
That makes sense.
Like, you know, a lot.
Well, so, this is how I look at it. Like, okay, if you're playing in the band, you're using a completely different part of your mind than when you're programming.
Right.
And when you're someone's engineer, you're using a completely different part of your mind than when you're programming or playing in a band.
But they all inform each other. That's what's really nice
about
it.
They do, but they're completely separate. It's no different than a film or a television show or an album or whatever. There's a reason why there are certain roles.
I see what you're saying.
And
you
personally can play multiple roles in multiple settings. And
yeah.
I don't think either any of them have to be sacrificed.
I think I just have this idea of myself that I just, you know, I feel like I don't know. I think when I am programming or something, it helps to be able to see it from the band's point of view.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, and you go through this, I'm sure, too, because
definitely.
You're in bands, too. So, like, you know,
also,
like,
that's why I don't know if about you for terms of programming, but number one, if you're not nice, I don't care who the hell you are.
Right.
You can't play here anymore.
Right.
I don't care how many people are here. Mm-hmm. I don't care how good at any instrument you are. There is someone else that is nicer than you that will make my night easier and make the experience for everyone else better.
Totally.
That's all that matters.
And that goes for everything, too. I mean, there are so many different places where you have the upper hand. You know, like, if you're recording someone's band, you're going to be able to make it sound the way you want it to sound because you're sitting behind the control desk.
Mm-hmm.
But why would you do that? That's not what you're there to do. You're there to make it sound like the band wants it to sound. You know what
I
mean?
So you're the Albini school. You're not the kind of the Rick Rubin school. You're not the Phil Spector school where this is actually my record and it's someone else's name on it.
I love both of those producers, but when it's my band, then I allow the specter in me to sort of come out, you know, because it's like, well, you know, I have a stake in this too.
Yeah.
But if I don't have a creative stake in it, then I'm just kind of a servant.
That's fine.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong.
No, it's good.
With
that. And you know, maybe just to try to bring it full circle, I like being able to, like, move in between different roles. Like, I like, you know, I think there's different things at play in whatever role you have to know what your role is in any situation. So if I'm playing Tom Petty at a bar, that's different than playing drums with Roommate at the Whistler or recording drums with Love Raiden. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But having sort of a, for lack of a better word, maybe like sort of critical thinking skills to sort of decide like what really is at play here and what are the proper priorities to have for whatever project you are in the moment. That, I think, is what makes it work or not.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, of course you can say, like, I'm the drummer and that's my job, and I just, you know, you take it or leave it. Doesn't seem like the right attitude.
And I've played with that drummer. That's why I said played in the past.
Yeah, I think I know him, too.
We're going to wrap this up with two things. You got to plug stuff at the end, but that might take 10 minutes. So we're going to go with a question from the Kids Book of Questions by Gregory Stack, PhD. Mm. A really awful book. So there's 260 questions. Please pick between 1 and 260.
I guess I will go for 167.
167. 167. If a rich kid wanted to buy your parents, how much would you ask them, assuming you were willing to sell? Would you trade parents with any of your friends?
Hmm. No, I mean, I this is funny because this already came up. No, I think I really do have the best parents. I probably wouldn't trade them.
Different backgrounds, my friend, different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. All right, let's plug your stuff. We need to start now.
Okay. The most important is Homeroom Presents 101 at the Hungry Brain.
Now he's literally pulling out an old school calendar. It's the first Monday. It's the second Monday in February. Go ahead.
It's going to feature Sean Campbell, former what was the title?
WLEW program director.
Program director and currently spearheading the Chicago Independent Radio Project is going to talk about that project.
Chirp,
and that's going to be great. And that's going to be in collaboration with You, Me, Them, Everybody, of course.
You could plug the other homeroom stuff, man.
Yeah, there's a lot. I would say we're just getting ready to launch what we're calling our spring semester, which includes a few different series that we do, including a YouTube assembly at the Nightingale and a songwriter series that we do at Elastic in Logan Square. So the website for that is homeroomchicago.org.
Homeroomchicago.org. And what about the bands?
The bands, a lot of exciting stuff happening with that. I have a gig with Roommate on March 10th. We're opening for Caliphone at Lincoln Hall. We're very excited about that.
Caliphone will actually be the next Chicago Music Podcast. A lot of critics, number one of
so
the year.
So good. The movie is good, too.
I haven't seen the movie yet.
It's really good.
I haven't seen the movie yet. So
So those guys are great. We are lucky to be playing that.
And you're opening for them, and they're opening for Wilco on their tour.
Damn, that's great. See, it all trickles down. These Chicago guys.
Kind of.
It's just, you know.
What about the other bands?
Other bands. Love Raid is releasing a record really soon on February 2nd, and then we're going to be playing at Kohl's in Logan Square on the 5th.
You got to tell me how that goes. I've been thinking about starting a night there.
Kohl's is great.
I've been there once, and I've heard awesome things about Cole, but I haven't met him yet.
Yeah.
And I want to go on a non-comedy night. I was there on a Wednesday, and I love the two. Maybe the reason why I liked it so much is because I like the hosts.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I got
to
go.
You got to come. I'll introduce you to Cole. He's the best.
Please do.
I really have high hopes for that place. I think it's a great setup.
Yeah, it's great. It's a it's a new bar in Logan Square. It used to be a pool hall. It's right off the Chicago.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's why it's
that.
If you actually go outside and you look up at the awning, the inner part of the awning, it still has the old logo.
Wow, how about that?
Yeah.
It's given all of us Logan Square people a nice reason to never have to go to Ronnie's again.
Yeah, Ronnie's was awesome for
a while. It was, and I have a lot of love for Ronnie's. Same here. But it's nice to not have to go there anymore.
Definitely. Is that it? Is that all the plugs we have? Are you on Twitter?
No, we've been talking about having a Twitter account for Homeroom.
No. I thought Homeroom does have one.
I think we do, but I don't participate in it yet.
You should get your own Twitter, man. You have so many different projects, and you have stuff like probably four nights of the week.
I'm kind of coming to terms with Facebook.
No, screw that. Go straight. Here's the good thing about Twitter. You can link up your Facebook like status updates to your Twitter account.
That's
so I'm never in Facebook
what they've been
anymore.
Telling me.
Just use Twitter. I love it.
Okay, it's so everyone sick. Be my Twitter.
Be your Twitter.
Is that how
it doesn't matter. Follow him on
Join
Twitter.
My Twitter.
You have to have a thing for his
club.
We do have a Twitter thing. The name is YMTE, so it's at YMTE. Follow us on Twitter. We have events every Monday night at the Hungry Brain, like Seth mentioned. And the next one is the Accountants of Homeland Security presents President Turtle. I did not name that. They named that. It's a variety show. It's four or five stand-up comics, a juggler, no joke, some sketch comedy, an acoustic rock comedy thing. It's not bad. I know that sounds awful, but really, it's actually funny. Trust me on that one.
I love juggling.
I'm excited to see that guy fail. Like, I know it's gonna fail. Either he's gonna drop some stuff, or like no one's gonna get it, and
that's
it'll just
the secret
be
promise of juggling. Yeah,
it's so great.
Yeah.
And then the week after that, please come out to the week after that. We're doing a live podcast recording with guests Adam Burke, who has been on the show before, one of the funniest comedians in Chicago, Jackie Ryan, a journalist, and Al Scorch, one of the best punk bluegrass, etc., whatever the hell you want to call them. There's videos of them on the feed, so please come to that. Me and Merle will be there hosting it. Thanks to Seth. We're going to close with the roommate track. Check out homeroomchicago.org.
Yeah.
.net.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
Org.
It's homeroomchicago.org, Love Raid Roommate, etc., and have a wonderful evening.